You can constrain yourself, and humans do this all the time, right? We put ourselves on diets. We take the alarm clock if you're a teenager and you put it on the other side of the room. You do things that force yourself into making some tricky, difficult decisions. And over the long run, actually, you're happy that you have constrained yourself. And so Buchanan talks about the necessity to for governments to constrain themselves and to make choices where they limit their future choices.
Realities of Socialism podcast. I'm Rosemary Fike, and today we are going to talk about Denmark. Denmark is not typically a country that you would think of as traditionally socialist, but in this podcast, we're talking about what socialism is and what it isn't. And I'm going to be joined by Dr. Matthew Mitchell to clear up any misconceptions about the type of economic system that Denmark has. Matt Mitchell is a senior fellow in the Center for Economic Freedom. He is a long-serving fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and a senior research affiliate at the Nee Center for the Study of Occupational Regulation at West Virginia University. He's authored many articles and books, including the one we're going to talk about today, The Free Enterprise Welfare State, A History of Denmark's Unique Economic Model, which he co-authored with Lars Christensen, Bacchus Barua, Jake Fuss, Paige McPherson, and Mackenzie Moir. That's going to be the topic of our discussion today, and it refers to Denmark as a free enterprise welfare state, which might sound like an oxymoron. So I want Matt to kind of explain to us what that means and why we would be talking about Denmark in a podcast about socialism.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. It's always great to see you. I think for those who actually, you know, have some familiarity with Denmark, that's your last question is absolutely right. Like, why would we be talking about this? Because it really is not a socialist state. I think the answer is that it is widely perceived, at least in North America, to be a socialist state. You know, it's folks like Bernie Sanders point to Denmark as an ideal system. This is somewhat ironic because this is a system, you know, that is quite free market, significantly more free market, I think, than Bernie Sanders is typically used to advocating, right? So, you know, this is a system where they have some of the, by one measure, you might look at the Economic Freedom of the World Index that Fraser publishes on a regular basis, and it divides economic freedom into five different components, or it constructs, you know, a comprehensive measure of economic freedom from these five components. And overall economic freedom, Denmark is the fifth freest country in the world. So it's really, really high up there. Its legal system and property right in the latest edition of the index was second in the world. Sound monetary policy, it's 11th. Freedom to trade internationally, it's 31st. In terms of low regulations, it's fourth. The one exception is it does have a large size of government. So that is 142nd out of 165 countries, but it sort of manages.
Thought it was so interesting in the book where you mentioned that if Denmark actually had a size of government that was more comparable with some of the other economically free countries, I think you said the top 30, what would they look like in terms of economic freedom overall if they had a smaller size of government?
Yeah, there's no question they'd be the most economically free country in the world.
That kind of blew my mind, because you don't think about because when I do think of Denmark, I do think of a very generous welfare state. And when my students, you're right, there is this misperception that Denmark is socialist, because when my students often talk about, you know, socialist countries, they look to the Nordic states, they look to Denmark as example. And so I think before we get in too deep about what is going on in the Danish system, can you talk about what traditional socialism is. I love to start these podcast episodes off with that, just in case we have new listeners that aren't quite familiar with traditional socialism and how that contrasts with Denmark's model.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great place to start. So, I mean, I think probably the easiest way to think about traditional socialism is to look at the definition that socialists themselves have used in the past. And so their definition is the state owns and controls the means of production. So one way to think about this is I remember a few years ago, Michael Moore was on, I think he was probably on the David Letterman show, and he was talking about, you know, all the decisions that private companies made. And he said, we really ought to just bring democracy to the economy and we should take a vote on these things. That is traditional socialism. It's the idea that the government actually is deciding how resources are allocated, what businesses are making, how they're making it, when they're making it, where they're making it, and what they're doing. So it's government control of the means of production. Now, he, of course, wanted it to be democratic control. In reality, most socialist states are not democratic states. They tend toward dictatorships. But the real key is that the government is controlling resources. And so, you know, we've got books on, as I've talked to you about Poland, we've got another book on Estonia. These are actual examples of real socialism where the government is controlling the means of production. But that definition, Denmark is nowhere near a socialist state.
Certainly not today, but as we might touch on later, they have had historical experiments where they leaned a little closer to that traditional definition. But as we know it today, Denmark is incredibly economically free. The market is deciding a lot of how to allocate resources. So I would love to talk a little bit about why people think Denmark is a socialist country. So what is the Danish model? What does that look like? And highlight how that is different from socialism.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think what people are gravitating towards or, focusing on when they are, asserting that this is a socialist system is Denmark does, no doubt about it, have a large welfare state. So as a percentage of GDP, they spend more than most other governments do. I'd note, by the way, there's kind of an interesting phenomenon here that it shows that timing sort of matters here. So I have a friend from Latin America who is recently opining that a lot of Latin American countries, they try to grow their size of government without and having never established much economic freedom in the other dimensions. And that's one of the reasons why it doesn't work particularly well. So Denmark kind of went the opposite direction where they've got this long tradition of, really pretty market-oriented economy. It's easy to start a business, regulations are low, things like that. And then later added a relatively large size of government. And I think that may account for some of the reason why, they've managed to achieve pretty high levels of income that other countries that try it kind of do it backwards don't achieve. So they've got this large government, but there's even in terms of that, I think there are wide misperceptions about how that government is actually paid for. So their two largest sources of income are a national sales tax, what we call a VAT tax, and it's a 25% rate, one of the highest in the world. Only Hungary has a higher rate, so Denmark's tied with Sweden and Norway at 25%. But this is a tax that everybody pays. It's a very, in the U.S. we often talk about sales taxes as being a regressive tax because it accounts for a higher percentage of people's income if they are low income people. So that's an important factor. And then the other factor is it has it also funds it with a personal income tax rate, which is also very high. It's a 57% personal income tax rate. But that top marginal rate kicks in at a very low share of income. You know, it kicks in at one fifth the level of income, the threshold of the United States. So while it has a high tax rate, it's basically everybody in the country is paying for it. So I think those are two, you know, really important aspects of this large size of government that people often don't quite appreciate.
One of the things you say in the book is that Denmark has as close to the optimally efficient tax system that economists talk about. So what does it mean to have an efficient tax, and why are things like a value-added tax or the way that Denmark structures their income tax, why is that seen as efficient? Or I think you also refer to it as non-distortionary. So explain what that means.
Yeah. So, you know, in simple terms, all taxes, of course, discourage whatever economic activity they are applied to, right? And so the less they discourage economic activity, then we consider them to be a more efficient tax. So in general, tax systems that are weighted towards consumption rather than towards production tend to be more efficient, because you ideally want people to have an incentive to produce, right? You want them to have an incentive to engage in economic activity. So that's an important area. It's not a highly progressive tax system in the sense that, you know, as you earn income, you're not going to be hit with higher and higher tax rates, because again, that top marginal tax rate kicks in at a very comparatively low level. And so because of that, the marginal effect of more effort, more income is not discouraged.
Right.
You're not going to be, you know, suddenly hit this cliff where, geez, if I make more money or my business makes more money, boom, I have a higher marginal tax rate. That's relatively low. And then you also see that in terms of corporate income taxes, which are, you know, quite low in Denmark. So for all of these reasons, you have to start with, does it discourage economic activity? And it doesn't, compared as much as other tax systems like the US or Canada.
Yeah, I think about my sister a lot. She's an anesthesiologist. And a couple of years ago, she reduced her hours from full time to three quarter time because she would actually take home more money after taxes by cutting back her hours. And you know, if I'm getting a surgery at her hospital, I really want her to be my anesthesiologist. She's great at what she does. So those high marginal tax rates, they can really discourage people from offering their very important services to the rest of the world.
That's right. And just a quick point on that, you know, if you think about the kinds of people that are going to be more discouraged. So one, you know, somebody who owns their own business or is a high earner who is able to set their hours a little bit, that, of course, is going to be somebody who's more likely to be sensitive to high marginal tax rates. And we find that in the data, but also secondary earners.
Right.
So if your spouse earns more than you, and your income is essentially kind of a cherry on the top for your family. It's something that you can take a job or not take a job. You can do work or you can stay home with the kids. Those types of earners are also especially sensitive to high marginal tax rates, we find.
And interestingly, secondary income earners are going to be more likely to be female in most instances. And so women are going to kind of bear a lot of that burden disproportionately. One thing that also jumped out at me in the discussion of Denmark's tax system is the type of taxes it doesn't have, right? And so no Social Security type of tax, very, very low tax revenue coming from taxes on property ownership. And even though the US and Denmark have pretty comparable tax rates for corporations, Denmark actually ends up collecting a larger amount of revenue, if I understood that correctly.
Yeah, that's right. And I should have mentioned this too, in talking about an efficient tax system, is you don't want a system that double taxes. And so they make a pretty significant effort to try to tax the same stream of income only once. And so, you know, that too is really a efficient aspect of the system.
I joke about how I get taxed on my income and then I get taxed when I spend my income and over and over and taxed on my property and all of that.
Yep.
So another aspect of Denmark's kind of fiscal system that you really highlight in the book is that they're committed to fiscal responsibility. So they have a social welfare system that is going to be really expensive. So the temptation to go into public debt might be really high. How does Denmark avoid accumulating the kind of debt that we see in the United States?
Yeah, that's right. And so one answer to this is that they haven't always avoided this. So they really, you alluded to earlier that they have experimented with larger government. And they did so in the 70s and 80s, and it brought some of the sort of predictable results, high inflation, high unemployment rates, stagnant growth, and then ultimately a spiraling deficit and debt problem. And really, things turned around in the 1990s, and they made a concerted effort to simply spend less than they bring in revenue. And one of the things I think that's kind of interesting about this when you look into how this happened is that this is not something that was really driven by, you know, one party or one ideology. There sort of has emerged this consensus from both left and right in Denmark that you just can't spend more than you bring in revenue. It's just not a sustainable pattern. And so they have constrained themselves. They actually have, debt and deficit rules that limit spending to certain mechanisms. So, for example, deficits need to stay within what's called the Maastricht Treaty. They now abide by rules that say that debt can't exceed 60% of the economy and deficits can't exceed 3% of GDP in any particular year. And so this kind of system, now that does mean that you can run short-term deficits, but you need to pay up, you need to make up for it over the long run, just think of it like a family. Family kind of has to stick to certain long run rules. It's okay to, run up the credit card one month or another, but you got to pay it off over the next month or else it spirals into something that is ultimately going to undermine, your standard of living. And so part of the reason why they're able to fund a relatively generous welfare system is because debt and deficits are kept under control in this country. So it's across the board. This is something that's supported left, right, and center, and you can kind of see the logic of why that would be.
I think it's fascinating because I teach intermediate macro, and I always teach a very U.S.-centered type of course, and I tell my students that in the U.S., deficits are the norm. Surpluses rarely happen. We haven't had them since the 90s, but in Denmark, the opposite is kind of true. The surpluses tend to be really frequent.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, just in recent years, they ran up some deficits following the Great Recession. But by 2014, they were in surplus. They were in surplus 2015, 16, 17, 18, 2019. It's remarkably mature system in the sense that it just, recognizes what most people who have to balance their own checkbooks recognize is it's not a sustainable model to run chronic deficits.
And that's even more surprising since they are a member of the EU and the Eurozone. So you would think that there would be some incentive to kind of free ride off of the fiscal responsibility of other states that are part of that. But Denmark has really resisted that. And it's through these constitutional rules.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's a play here between, institutions and culture that is interesting and probably, from a social scientist perspective, it's difficult for us to truly separate out and say what is what. The EU does itself actually have rules that are designed to try to keep member states within certain bounds, precisely because they don't want people to have to or they don't want states to free ride on the whole system. But from what I understand, you know, there's a lot of folks that in Denmark that say that they are the political culture there is such that there isn't a strong effort to really even try to change these rules. They're pretty happy to be constrained. And so this kind of reminds me of, you know, that there's a political economist that I know you know quite well, James Buchanan, won the Nobel Prize in 1986. And one of the things he talks about is he uses this metaphor of Ulysses tying himself to the mast. And it's the idea that if you're a rational person and you know you might make mistakes down the line, you know, you might be tempted to steer your ship into the rocks to hear the sirens, you can constrain yourself. And humans do this all the time, right? We put ourselves on diets. We take the alarm clock if you're a teenager and you put it on the other side of the room. You know, you kind of, you do things that force yourself into making some tricky, difficult decisions. And over the long run, actually, you're happy that you have constrained yourself. And so Buchanan talks about the necessity to for governments to constrain themselves and to make choices where they limit their future choices. And that's really essentially what the Danish political culture and the institutional system has done here in, you know, adopting these rules that say deficits, you can run them for a short period of time, but they can't exceed 3% of GDP, and debt can't exceed 60% of GDP. And they've managed to, you know, build, I think, a prosperous state by staying within these bounds.
So they're fiscally responsible. They're largely economically free. They have incentives that encourage people to be productive and participate in the economy. And they still are able to have a pretty generous social welfare system. So I think we should kind of turn towards a discussion of you know, what type of social safety nets does Denmark have? And how are they funded? And what does that look like for the average Dane?
Yep. So there's certain aspects of their social safety nets that in my reading of it, they're essentially pretty consistent with sort of the norm for OECD countries, your norm for other European countries in particular. So for example, I don't think that their universal healthcare system is particularly far outside the norm. In terms of public funding, in terms of patients themselves actually do not have much of a stake in the system in terms of co-pays or anything like that. So it's not all that market oriented. And they achieve outcomes that are pretty comparable to other countries. You know, on some markers, they have worse outcomes. On others, they have better outcomes. So I don't think there's anything especially out of noteworthy about that. Their education system, on the other hand, is pretty noteworthy, much to the surprise, again, of, certain North American politicians, I think, would be surprised to know that they have universal school choice, that local schools have quite a bit of autonomy in terms of their curriculum, in terms of their programming and their systems. And large percentages of Danes go to use public funds. The funds follow the students and they take them to private schools. So one way to look at this is the percentage of enrollment in private schools, and that's 16%. That's 16% of all Danish students take public funds and take them to private schools. Another way to look at it is the percentage of schools. 45% of schools in Denmark are private schools. So if you kind of, triangulate the math from those two, that means that these tend to be relatively smaller schools. They're more boutique types of schools. There's quite a bit of variety. Not all the private schools, to be honest, emphasize, rigorous education. Some of them emphasize special needs tailored type of education. Others emphasize, vocational education, and others do emphasize a rigorous education. You've kind of got, because of this, great degree of choice and flexibility, there's also quite a bit of sort of entrepreneurship, and people really have a variety of different types of systems to choose from. And, you know, really the proof is in the pudding. Denmark has quite high achievement rates when you look at international standards. And their private schools have higher achievement rates than the public schools. So both, and the Danish system, by the way, the government itself emphasizes that the public schools are improved by this private competition, but it also seems clear that the private schools are improved by this private competition as well.
Yeah, and in looking at the data that you present in the book, it seems like you know, that 16% of the population that is now in those independent schools, that's actually higher than it was about a decade ago. And if you look even further back, so there's been a shift in where people are sending their schools.
That's right. And there's also
which schools they're sending their students to.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there's also, you know, a change in terms of the performance too. So if you go back a couple decades ago, the Danish students enrolled in these private schools were not outperforming the public school counterparts, and now they are. So, you know, that again, as more Danes have been availing themselves of this opportunity to take the money with them and with the student and, you know, going to the schools of their choice, the competition seems to have heated up a little bit and you're getting better outcomes.
So it seems like there might be some interesting natural experiment opportunities to study the impact of school choice on educational outcomes for people who are interested in those questions. Denmark seems like a good place to look. What other types of social safety nets in Denmark are worth discussing in our conversation today?
So I think, you know, in other respects, kind of similar to the healthcare, I don't see their public pensions or their welfare or their unemployment systems as especially far outside the norm. I would emphasize the unemployment system, again, kind of harkening back to what happened in the 1990s with spiraling inflation and high unemployment rates. It does really try to emphasize getting people back to work. It does mm-hmm. really try to emphasize what they call workfare, where they are trying to spend money on retooling and educating people and getting them the tools to get back in the workforce rather than necessarily, you know, keeping them out of the workforce. And so I think that's maybe something to emphasize. Their pension system, it's also probably worthwhile emphasizing that there are large private voluntary, you know, pensions offered by private companies, not compulsory. That is a big aspect of the system. But in other respects, it's a, you know, relatively, you know, standard sort of set of welfare, social safety net systems that are where what's unique is that they are funded, again, through this by the average Danes. It's not like they foist the entire cost onto the highest earners, which, by the way, I guess also kind of brings us back to when we're talking about, you know, what's the definition of socialism? And, you know, the beginning of our conversation, one of the things you asked is, how do you define it? It's also worth thinking through how do non-economists, how do just people on the street define socialism? And, you know, surveys suggest that large percentages of people in North America, in Great Britain and Australia, they perceive socialism to simply be a system with a generous welfare state and also that's paid for with taxes on highest earners. Well, if it's paid for by taxes on the highest earners, by that definition, Denmark is not socialist because, again, it's got a broadly shared tax burden.
And that's something in one of the books in the Realities of Socialism series. It's also on Sweden. And that was surprising for me to learn that there's a similar, you know, you're funding this through taxes. You're largely paying for the benefits yourself throughout the course of your lifetime. And so that is very different than most outsiders look and say, we want a very, very heavily redistributive state. That's not what we're really looking at here.
That's right. That's right. And it kind of emphasizes, you know, if you want to think about it philosophically, you know, there's a one of the more celebrated philosophers on the left in the last half century. It's John Rawls. And he emphasizes the idea that, well, we would want a generous welfare state if you didn't know what kind of, you know, condition you would be born into. But that emphasizes that it would be, it's like an insurance, you know, it's a public insurance system that we all pay for in case we find that that we're, you know, have a grave misfortune. But again, it's, we all pay for it, right? You know, it's not a system that is, we're just going to try to foist the cost onto, you know, a small share of the population. And, you know, as you're aware too, the math of a system that is a very generous welfare state that's paid for by a small percentage of the population, that just doesn't really work. You know, it's not, it set aside the disincentive effects and the maybe the potential philosophical effects that, you know, concerns there. It actually just doesn't mathematically work out that you can have the kind of welfare state that Denmark has without generating a lot of revenue from VAT taxes and personal income taxes that have low thresholds that, you know, everybody pays.
And one of the things I also noticed in looking at the chapter on social safety nets is that there, as you mentioned, with pensions, there are private pensions that like 80% of the population is also paying into, similar to unemployment benefits. There's supplemental insurance that people are paying into at a pretty large rate. So they are participating in their own care in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right.
One of the things we haven't really talked about that is something mentioned in the book that I thought was pretty interesting is Denmark is one of the countries that offers really extensive benefits to encourage people to be parents. Even some of the public pension schemes, you get more money if you are a parent. Denmark has subsidies for childcare, daycare subsidies. There's paid maternity benefits and parental benefits, not just for mothers. They're available to fathers too. So how, you know, what did that look like? How was, you know, do you think that that has had some, you know, they have a pretty high level of labor force participation, a pretty high level of employment. Do you think that those types of benefits disincentivize work in any degree? Or do you think that those are useful programs that could help women better participate in the market?
So, I mean, I think it's, you know, I hate to give an economist answer here, but I think it is probably a one hand and the other hand kind of situation. So, you know, from the benefit side, if you are a parent and you don't have to, if you're thinking about having another child and you having another child wouldn't require you to leave the workforce, then of course that is, that's great. If you can rely on a generous system that allows you to do that. On the other hand, you have to pay for the systems, right? And so if that type of system were funded by a U.S. Marginal tax system or with very high marginal tax rates as you get into higher incomes, I am, you know, quite skeptical that the system would provide the same type level of encouragement for people to stay in the workforce.
Right. And I just, you can't really talk about, you know, women's labor market issues without people pointing to Denmark and the other Nordic states as kind of a shining example of what the rest of the developed world ought to follow. And there is that kind of paradox that, you know, even though there's lots of women working in these states, that the rates at which they make it to management positions or have any kind of leadership positions is a lot lower than that of women in the United States, where none of those types of programs exist through the federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've covered a lot of ground. So I want to ask, you know, is there anything that we haven't really had a chance to talk about too deeply that that you think is really important that we should kind of take a step back and touch on?
So I think it's important maybe to emphasize that, I think one of the ways that Denmark has managed to achieve this system is broad consensus, right? So, I think it's tempting to think like, oh, all we need to do is to get everybody to think like we do and, you know, want to have free markets, economic freedom, limited government, sort of the classical liberal perspective. But in many ways, the way that you, I think, can achieve progress is by trying to help other people appreciate that, you know, their values are served by this set of policies, this set of institutions. So, you know, the way they are able to provide a relatively generous welfare state is by being cognizant of the disincentive effects of high marginal tax rates, cognizant of the disincentive effects of extensive regulations or barriers to trade or bad monetary policy or bad protection of property rights. You know, once you appreciate that those types of policies matter and we are all on the same page on that, then it's easier to have what I think are actually much more constructive conversations about how do we build a society that works for everyone. And it didn't happen necessarily by, you know, right-wing politicians beating everyone else over the head. It happened by a national conversation and a national consensus that emerged from really a fiscal crisis in the 1990s that made it clear to everybody that they couldn't continue on that path with ever-growing government and ever decreasing interest in actually funding that government and just going into greater and greater debt. So I think the more we kind of get on the same page about some basics and agree that this is sort of we need to be building consensus, the better.
All right. It seems like one of the main takeaways from the Denmark experience is if we want to have a social welfare system that is expensive, then we need to create the incentives that generate enough wealth to pay for that system, right? It's very much a story to me of there is no such thing as a free lunch. Right? We're paying for what we get. So we should have the rules in place to encourage wealth creation and in order to be able to afford it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And you got to kind of recognize that new wealth has to be created every single day in order to keep a system like this going. I think if you read some socialist tracts, there's kind of this idea, Marx, of course, waxed poetically about the productive power of capitalism and talked about how the bourgeoisie had created more wealth in a few generations than had been created in 100 generations before that. And so he kind of had this idea that, okay, now that we're wealthy, we could just redistribute and change and have a socialist system. But we know that doesn't work. You have to continue to have people have an incentive to want to produce, to want to serve one another in a market economy. And in order to do that, you got to be attentive to economic freedom. You have to make sure that people have an ability to make economic decisions on their own. That they can trade what they want with whom they want on the terms that they want with relatively little interference from central planners or the state.
As one of your frequent co-authors, Pete Betke, sometimes says, you don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. You need the incentives to be to encourage that production and that wealth creation.
Yep.
So before we end, are there any lessons you think that countries like the U.S., Canada can take away from Denmark? Some policy changes that we really can learn from and follow Denmark as a leader?
Yeah, I mean, I would go to the Economic Freedom of the World Index, look at the metrics and the indicators on which they score quite well, and in many cases better than in the United States and Canada. You know, first and foremost, stopping the disincentives to accumulate capital. You know, high marginal tax rates on corporations, high tax rates on income are not necessarily the way to achieve a goose with a golden egg, right? So opening up the economy, making it easier to start businesses, sound monetary policy, and low tariffs, low barriers to international trade. These are, you know, kind of basic lessons that I think economists have been trying to teach for decades, if not centuries. And now we have just mounds of empirical evidence to suggest, yeah, these sort of basic rules, they really do work, right? And then, you know, fiscal rectitude. However much you want to spend, that's great. But you got to pay for it. You can't systematically spend more than you bring in revenue. It's just not a sustainable pattern.
Anytime I look at the website that's the U.S. debt clock, I almost have a heart attack because it is just an amount of debt that I can't even wrap my head around. And that is the one lesson that I really wish that some of our modern governments can take away from Denmark, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, before we wrap up, are there any other book recommendations, any other resources you'd like to point listeners in the direction of?
So, I mean, I think this is, I'd encourage people to look at the broader project here again, the Realities of Socialism project. We've got now books on Denmark and Sweden, both because they're perceived to be socialist countries that aren't, but then also books on Poland, which you and I have talked about, and Estonia, which hopefully we'll talk about soon. And then we've got a book on Singapore, which is neither socialist nor even perceived as socialist, but it's an interesting exploration of, you know, a completely different system. And then with all of these projects, all of these books, there are just loads of resources. There's short videos, long videos. There's obviously podcasts, and then there's infographics. So all of this is, you know, prime for sharing and distributing on social media. And so I encourage your listeners to check it out. Lots and lots of resources here.
Read the books, listen to the podcasts, and definitely come back and learn more about the realities of socialism with me. Thank you so much, Matt. It was a pleasure speaking with you today, and I hope to speak with you again soon.
Thanks so much, Rosie. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for the Realities of Socialism podcast, where we take a deep dive into the consequences of socialism as it was imposed on tens of millions of people during the 20th century. For more information, including infographics, free books, and more podcast episodes, visit realitiesofsocialism.org.